Okay, I guess I'll call the new class to order. I'm so glad to be back in our normal time slot. It's quite a relief from Thursdays. I'm sure it's not just a relief to me. What I'd like to do actually with this class is just quickly summarize where we are and then push ahead forward by taking a little bit of a step back into something that we did last time. I think we only had two or three people the last one we were here, so we're going to review just a drop and then move on to completely new material. Just in terms of where we are, sort of a state of the union, what we've done the previous semester is try to explore how Judaism finds its expression in the way that we recognize it by examining where the shul comes from. We identified the shul as having roots, at least archaeologically speaking, primarily in Egypt, and we discussed how really the early sources for how the shul develops are devoid of temple imagery, and temple imagery comes later. That's going to be a theme that picks up a little bit later on, because Chazal actually perpetuate that ambivalence rather than endorsing it, I think, as we might imagine. But we'll pick that up in a little bit. Then we took a look at sort of the state of Jewish law, and we saw how there was sort of a bit of a chaos within the context of early Jewish law that the rabbis eventually, as we're going to see, bring order to. And so if we see developments in early Judaism that don't seem to conform to what we know from later rabbinic sources, that shouldn't surprise us so much, because Chazal's project, as it was to bring discipline to a system that was, broadly speaking, at least by the end of the Second Temple period, we probably should even use the word in disarray. What I'd like to do here is examine some of the early evidence, both on the archaeological side and also on the rabbinic side, to basically ask a question that's going to serve as a test case for us. And that is, to what extent do rabbis have influence? We already covered the question of in Jewish law, and the answer that we saw is that it's complicated. But what about in the question of Jewish institutional practice as we get a little bit later, into the Common Era, and in particular in the shul? The shul was sort of a theme of ours last semester. So the question I want to ask this semester, or I want to ask in this class, is to what extent can we talk about rabbinic values as we conceive of them, and that's an important qualifier. To what extent can we talk about rabbinic values as we conceive of them as being present in the synagogue as it develops? And if the answer is we cannot, then two questions that we're going to have to ask are, first of all, how do we explain that? And second of all, perhaps that should require us to reassess what we think rabbinic values are, and that's going to lead us into our summation in the end of the class. So what I'd like to do here in this particular class is take a step back to a class that we did right before the semester break. It actually isn't on YU Torah, so for those of you who missed it, this will be all new. For those of you who were here, this will be a review, because we ran through the material a little too quickly. This will be a good refresher. What I'd like to do here in source number one is take a look at the little picture that you have on the top left over here. The top left over here is a mosaic floor from a shul in Chamat Tveria. It's the floor here is dated to the 4th century of the Common Era, and it is distinct for its very detailed mosaic floor, although it's certainly not unique by any stretch of the imagination, but it has a very detailed mosaic floor. And what I'd like to do before we move any further, and if you remember the answer from previous classes, don't blurt it out. If you don't remember, then feel free. But what I'd like to do is identify some of the imagery on the floor and then ask the questions that I think it's very obviously going to raise. So now, let's take a look at both panels. So what kind of images do we recognize here? There's some that should be obvious, so we should point those out first. There's a menorah, right? You would expect that in a shul. There's an ark, right? There's an Aron Kodesh, that you would expect as well. There's a lulav, also you would expect. Right, there's a shofar. What's on top of the shofar? Right, it's a machta, right? It's an incense shovel. Right? It's a machta. So also something that derives from the Beis HaMikdash. We've basically exhausted that top panel.
It's on the left.
On the left. Where on the left?
The far left. Right,
another lulav, right.
So what's on the far left? Is that another?
That's another lulav. That's another lulav. Another lulav. Now, what I think we should notice is that of the images that we've been picking out, the obvious ones, even some of the not so obvious ones, they've all been in which panel? The top one. That's not by accident. What's in the bottom panel?
Zodiac.
Right, it looks like a zodiac. In particular, who is in the middle of that zodiac?
Is that the thunder?
Yes, it's not right. So it is a god. It's not Zeus. It's Helios. It's Apollo. Now, how do we know it's Apollo? Well, there are a couple ways we know. First of all, because it says. Second of all, you. Yeah, the print here is not so good. But even if it didn't say, actually this one may not say. But even if it didn't say, there are ways that it's where we can. There are obvious hints that this is Helios. Number one, if you can, again, I apologize for the print quality. He's holding a globe and he has the rays of sun bursting out of his head. Right. So this is the sun god. This is Helios, the sun god. In, I think it's going to be the next class where we're going to really discuss the particulars of how Helios, the Greek sun god, is received in Jewish tradition. That's actually a very, very important question, and it requires us to really be ma'ayin in the words of Chazal, and in some of the words of Tanakh as well. But leaving aside the question of Helios specifically, qua Helios for a moment, well, we have to ask ourselves, what in God's name, well, no pun intended, what in God's name is Helios doing on the floor of a shul? This is the center of the shul. This is the very middle of the shul, right in front of the Aron Kodesh. Right, the decor committee really dropped the ball on this one.
When does this floor go back to?
This floor dates to the 4th century of the Common Era. So this is 100 years after the Mishnah.
And then this is way after the Greeks.
Well, so this is sort of the height of Greco-Roman imperial power. This is sort of the transition to the Byzantine period. I suppose is how we would identify it. The Mishnah was edited about 100 years before. This is well into the Yerushalmi period. So we have Helios on the floor of the synagogue. Now, what kind of questions might this raise for us?
Who are the other people on the bottom?
The bottom. So right. So if you'll notice, There are two people on the bottom here, and then there are also two people on the top in those corners of that panel. Those are the anthropomorphic personifications of the seasons, the four seasons. Right. Listen, Helios is weird enough, but this just adds to the cognitive dissonance. So what sort of questions does this raise? Well, first of all, it raises the question of Why Helios, right? Why Helios in particular? Why would the sun god be in the shul? We're going to leave that for hopefully next time. But what other questions does it raise?
Well, graven images,
right? Dibur Hashem, the second commandment, depending on how you count, right? But we're going to read the second commandment in a second. So these first two sources are going to be familiar to people from last time. But take a look now at the second commandment, which I've given you, the one version of it I've given you over here on the right from Shemos. So the second commandment reads as follows. So with the preamble, Anochi Hashem Elokecha asher hotzeicha me'eretz Mitzrayim mi'beis avadim, lo yiyeh lecha Elohim acherim al panoi, lo sa'aseh lecha pesel v'chol tmuna asher v'shamayim mimala v'shem aretz mitachas v'asher b'mayim mitachas la'aretz, lo sishtachav elahem v'lo sa'avdeim, ki Anochi Hashem Elokecha el kana. Now let's pick out what exactly this says and what it doesn't say. First of all, God identifies himself. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods. Okay. You shall not make a graven image, nor any manner of likeness, anything that's in heaven above, or that's in the earth beneath, and so forth. You shall not bow down unto them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Now, what exactly, just on a first read here, what exactly does this commandment entail? So if we had to sum it up.
Don't worship images, but this is being placed not on a wall, but on a floor, and they're walking on it.
Right. Okay. So let's take a step back. Right. So first of all, the way that I want to read this this commandment enjoins monotheism. In other words, you can't worship other gods. You have to. In other words, you can't have other gods in a pantheon. You have to have one god. That's the way I think this needs to be read. Number one. Number two, there seems to be a particular issue with representations of gods, right? Los aselecha pesel v'chol tmunah. Right, you can't make graven images. It's not just that you can't, in the abstract, metaphysical sense, have other gods in your pantheon. You can't represent them in material form. That's another part of the commandment.
How do you determine material? Is it an idol? Is it a statue versus a rendition in a picture?
Right, good question.
Now, this is a two-dimensional representation. It's not really...
It says nor any manner of likeness.
Right. So.
Okay. So that.
Right. So we're going to have to get into this in a moment, as we're going to see the sugya in the Bavli. That actually is an issue. Meaning what sort of dimensions something has that comes into play. So let's put that in our back pocket for a second. But in other words, before we address the question of how do we explain away this particular mosaic floor, let's just figure out what the Dibor itself says. In other words, if we had to read it without knowing that later on somebody would set up a floor like this in Chamat Tveria, so if we could just read this in a vacuum, which I realize is a difficult, maybe impossible proposition, but if we could read the Dibor in a vacuum, what would it entail? So I think what Dr. Schwartzbaum is noticing is that there seems to be, there may be here a notion of dimensions being important, because the word that is used is pesel, which means something is engraved, which sounds like it's cut out of something. If you cut something out of something, so now you've given it volume. So now you've made something into a three-dimensional figure. So it's possible.
Yeah, but they play with shadowing in this mosaic. It's not flat.
Right. Well, in other words, the mosaic, that's an important point here is that this mosaic is not two-dimensional. That's an important. It's not a painting. In other words, this is not a two-dimensional. Right. It's not a two-dimensional mosaic.
It's carved and in executing, if they bothered to play with shadowing.
Right. In other words, right. True. There's right. So that is true.
You're going for the live look.
But it doesn't have a form.
Right. So it does. It also right. In other words, it's not like a sculpture. It's not a sculpture. That's true. But leaving aside the mosaic floor for a second, what I want to call attention to is Pasuk Dalet. Is Pasuk Dalet? So how do we read? Right. So another thing that we should keep in mind is what constitutes. Does it matter what you do with? In other words, what Mrs. Falk is raising is: does it matter what you do with this image, or is just having it, even if you treat it disrespectfully, is that bad enough? That's actually an important question. But I want to focus on Pasuk Dalet. Is Pasuk Dalet a separate problem, or is Pasuk Dalet qualifying? In other words, verse 4 says, "You shall not bow down unto them nor serve them." Right? Los ishtachavel lem los avdein. Is that a separate stipulation? In other words, let's put it in Lumdish terms. If you were to carve out a statue and then you were to worship it, would you be over al shtei yisurim, right? Would you have violated two prohibitions? Or is this all part of the same prohibition? And perhaps, what might, if it's all one prohibition, then what might the consequence of that be?
We say it's the same. Because it's a seret divrotz and it's anochi and lo yelechem are two separate.
Right. So
three.
Right. So as you're going to see, I don't want to anticipate the conclusions of the Bavli too much. I mean, because we'll get to it. But you're right. In other words, halacha does come to a particular conclusion about how to understand this dibor. But if we're reading it without those conclusions being assumed from the get go, so we're not going to answer this question now. But I think we will have an answer by the time we're done. I wanted to call attention to the fact that it's possible to read Pasuk Dalet in two different ways. It could either be further defining the character of this Dibor. In other words, you shall not have other gods. What does that mean? You shall not carve them out. What does that mean? You shall not worship them. So in other words, what we would have at the end of the day is a prohibition on worshiping graven images. And that would be the sum total of the second commandment. Or there could be three separate problems here. A, you're not allowed to have other, you're not allowed to worship other gods. Whether or not you worship other gods, you're not allowed to have graven images. and whether or not you violated any of those. If there's a graven image in front of you, you're not allowed to worship it. It's a totally separate thing. Those are the two ways that we could possibly have read this, and which one we pick is important. So now take a look at the source right below that from Malachim Beis. We could multiply examples like this maybe a dozen times, but this is a famous one. This is talking about Melech Hizkiyahu, King Hezekiah, and what it tells us in the beginning, in the beginning of the narration of his reign, in Malachim Beis, the pasuk says, "Hu heisiras abamos, vishibaras amatzevos, v'charasas asheira, v'chitas nechash hanachoshes." Asher asa Moshe, ki adoy memahema yuvnei Yisrael makaterim lo vayikra lo nechushton. What made Chizkiyahu famous, or what made him great? What Chizkiyahu did was he removed the high places, the type of place where you could sacrifice in private. He broke the pillars and cut down the Asherah trees, right? He got rid of those types of things. And he broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. If you'll recall, I believe it's in Sefer Bamidbar, where the people are crying out for water, or rather the people are being bitten by snakes. And Moshe carves this bronze, the snake out of copper, out of bronze, and the people are supposed to look at it, and that's going to be the remedy for the snakes. Now, before we go any further in translating the pasuk, so what's the theme of this pasuk? In other words, there basically, if you could sum up this pasuk, what makes Chizkiyahu great? What does he do? He gets rid of Avodah Zarah. Okay. He gets rid of Avodah Zarah. Now, how are we to interpret the last item on the list? He gets rid of the bronze serpent that Moses had made. Now, if Chizkiyahu's sterling characteristic, what makes him a superlative king, is that he eradicates idolatry, so then the straight implication of this, were we to read no farther, would be that Moshe himself had been guilty, God forbid, of instituting idolatry in Israel, and along comes Chizkiyahu and atones for that mistake. So notice the continuation of the pasuk. Now, what would lead us to that conclusion, by the way, were we to read no further? I think one particular interpretation of the second commandment. If we were to read Pasuk Dalid as a separate prohibition, then it would seem pretty straightforward that Moshe Rabbeinu was, at least in spirit, he was commanded to do this, but in spirit, Moshe was in violation of the second commandment. Why? Because he made a pesel. God forbid. He made a pesel, or he made a graven image. Why would this nechushtan, why would this bronze serpent not qualify as a violation of the second commandment? So what does the rest of the pasuk say? Ki adayim imahim ahayu b'nei Yisrael mekatrim lo. Why? Because unto those days the children of Israel did offer to it. In other words, what the pasuk is saying is that in the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, the people didn't worship this graven image. They made use of it. However, by the time of Hezekiah, by the time of King Chizkiyahu, when the idolatrous tendencies of the ancient Israelites were in full indulgent mode, so at this point, Chizkiyahu essentially is stuck in an Eis Lasos LaHashem point. In other words, he has to make a decision. This was a legitimate expression of faith. Moshe makes this bronze serpent for a completely justifiable purpose and left it among the Jewish people for innocent reasons. However, at this point, it had become an object of worship. That, for Chizkiyahu, was a problem because now it had transitioned from an acceptable object to a cultic object, to an object that's being worshipped, and as a result, it had to be destroyed. What's the implication of this analysis for our understanding of Pasuk Dalid?
That only a tmuna that is made that is worshipped is objectionable.
Excellent, right.
It's a picture, and it's not worshipped,
it's not. That seems to be exactly the straightforward implication of this vignette from the beginning of Malachim Beis. The second commandment forbids graven images, or maybe any images, from being worshipped, right? Mr. Comet was right to point out that it may not only be 3D images, but we'll have to leave that for a couple of minutes from now. But I think the straightforward implication of this story is that you can't have images if you're worshiping them. That's the problem. Worshiping images is the problem.
Are you saying that then, based on what you're saying, or we can make a statue of Yashka and say, okay, just making a statue. I'm having it in my house, but I'm not worshiping.
So I'm glad you brought that up, because what that question represents, I think, is a very incisive reductio ad absurdum, and it's exactly the type of reductio that we would expect Chazal to ask. If it's true that the second commandment includes only worshiping images but not making images, then you can make an image of. Just like you make an image of anything, you can make an image of, like you said, you can make an image of Yashka, and that would be acceptable. That's exactly the type of reductio ad absurdum that we would expect Chazal to ask. And if you'll hold that question for until source 3, you'll see that Chazal actually do indeed ask a version of that question. Now, to substantiate the point that I think Ellie is absolutely correct about her in her analysis of Malachim Beis, take a look at source number 2. We could do this with Philo, we could do this with any number of other, we could do this with the Targumim, we could do this with any number of other ancient Jewish sources, but Josephus is as good a place as any to start. How did Josephus understand what the second commandment was saying? Fortunately, Josephus left for us a summary of how he understood the Ten Commandments, and here is his summary of commandment number 2. And the second one commands us that we make not a single image of a live thing to worship it. So I've translated the Greek here very, very literally. The reason I've done that is because when we saw this source last time, we saw that there is the popular translation of this source, I think, shtups some extra words in here that aren't in there, that tried to make it seem like worshiping the statue is a separate issue. But I've rendered this for you as literally as I can. I think you'll see that what this is saying, and the second one, in other words, and the second commandment, commands us that we make not a single image of a live thing to worship it. So the Greek word there is proskunein. You are not allowed to make, in other words, that Greek word proskunein is what you would call in linguistics a purpose infinitive. What it does is it tells you you're not allowed to do X for the purpose of X, Y, and Z. That's what that purpose infinitive does. It tells you why you would be doing something or for what purpose you would be doing something. Here, the action, the activity that's being prohibited, namely making images, is being prohibited so that you don't worship it. In other words, the prohibited action here is making something in order to worship it. So the way that Josephus understands the Dibur Hasheni, the second commandment, is making things that are worshipped. Not just making graven images, but making worshipped graven images. Now, Adkan, the early, early, early Jewish sources. I want to turn to Chazal, because Chazal presents us with something of a conundrum. There is an entire, as I'm sure many of us are aware, there's an entire tractate, a rabbinic tractate in the Mishnah, and it's elaborated upon in both of the Talmuds that's called Avodah Zarah, and it's ostensibly dedicated to exploring and limiting the contours of the laws of idolatry. That text, by and large, ignores the second commandment, and instead, much of it is dedicated to exploring the nature of a related but distinct prohibition, which is the Isser Hana'a, the prohibition on deriving benefit from idolatry, which is learned from a separate source. Namely, take a look at the Mishnah here. This is one of the places where that source pops up. The Mishnah here actually asks Dr. Schwartzbaum's question, and moreover, it puts that question in the mouth of a philosopher. Shael praklos ben philosophos es rabben Gamliel ba'ako, shahaya rochets b'merchatz shel Ephroditi, amr lo, kos b'taraschem v'lo yidbak b'yadcha ma'uma menacherem. So basically, the kasha is as follows. This philosopher, Proclus, saw that Rabban Gamliel, this is a long bit of analysis, but this is most likely Rabban Gamliel III, who was the son of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, rather than the Rabbi Gamliel who lived at Yavne. So this is basically just about when the Mishnah is being, just after or just when the Mishnah is being put together. This is a late story in the Mishnah. How we know that is the subject of another shir. But in any event, Proclus the philosopher sees Rabbi Gamliel in the bathhouse, and the bathhouse is one that has a statue of Aphrodite in it. And he sees Rabbi Gamliel is just standing there in front of this statue, bathing. Moreover, it seems that this bathhouse has been dedicated to Aphrodite, which is not uncommon. In fact, bathhouses were very frequently dedicated to gods in the ancient Roman world, and the most popular god or goddess to whom bathhouses were dedicated was Aphrodite. So now, this is Aphrodite's bathhouse, and Rabbi Gamliel is making use of it. How could he do that? After all, says the philosopher, doesn't the Torah say, let nothing that has been condemned stick to your hand? In other words, nothing that is idolatrous are you allowed to derive any benefit from. So how can you derive benefit from this idolatrous bathhouse? That a philosopher, that a Gentile philosopher from this time should know how to cite scripture is actually probably accurate. The Neoplatonic philosophers were, at least many of them, were extremely proficient in scripture. Porphyry, one of the great Neoplatonic philosophers, he was a student of the philosopher Plotinus, who some people may have encountered in a classics course. Porphyry actually wrote a commentary on the book on the Book of Daniel, which is a very good commentary. So there were, the Neoplatonic philosophers were quite proficient in the scriptures, as if you will. But that's neither here nor there. I think it's just interesting. But the question's a good question. If you're not allowed to derive any benefit from an idol, so how can you be in this bathhouse here? So what does Rabbi Gamliel respond? So Rabbi Gamliel says, Amarlo, so he offers him a rather cryptic response, which we're not going to go in now, because it doesn't bear on our issue. But then the Mishnah adds, Ein omrim nasa merchatz noy l'afroditi, ela nasa hi afroditi noy l'merchatz. Davar acher, im nosen lach maman harbe, ata nichnas l'beis ol dazar shalach. Arum, ubalkeri, umashin befoneha, v'zo, umetas alabiv, v'cholam, mashtinim befoneha. Lo ne'amar ela alohe hem, es shehu noeg bo mishim aloha, asav esh'ena noeg bo minag aloha mutter. So there are basically three answers that the Mishnah offers here. They're all similar, even though there are nuances that distinguish them. But the basic point is as follows. First of all, we do not say that the bathhouse is made an adornment to Aphrodite, but rather Aphrodite is made an adornment for the bathhouse. What does that mean? So it can't mean, as some of the Rishonim take it, that the bathhouse was built as a regular bathhouse and then Aphrodite was put in there later. The overwhelming weight of Greco-Roman evidence is that that probably wasn't the case. What was the case was probably the bathhouse was built for Aphrodite. But what could this possibly mean?
It was a bathhouse that was not for Aphrodite. So he said, I used to come to this bathhouse, but she came to my bathhouse.
Right. So that.
So I didn't come to her bathhouse. She imposed on my bathhouse. I know that's not exactly what it is.
Right. So what Sally is remembering actually is Sally's calling me on the ellipses that I put in there. Sally's remembering the first answer of the Mishnah, which I left out, which is good. That was a risk I took on my part, and I'm glad someone called me on it. But that is the first answer that the Mishnah gives. Ani lo basa bigvula, he basa bigvuli. I came to her; she didn't come to me. What the Rishonim do take that to mean that originally the bathhouse was built without Aphrodite, and Rabbi Gamliel used to frequent it, and then Aphrodite came and sort of imposed on his idyllic bathhouse experience. I don't think that is how the Rishonim understand it. I don't think that that's the way it can be understood for several reasons. Number one, because bathhouses weren't just built stam, they were built with idols in them, and they were usually built for idols. So in all likelihood, what that answer means actually requires, I think, a shir on its own, which maybe we'll do this semester. It may be worthwhile, especially in this context. But leaving that aside, just bracketing that just for a moment, but Sally's absolutely correct that is what the Mishnah says. These other answers that the Mishnah offers, I think, are relevant, whatever the architectural history of the bathhouse, because what they're telling us is as follows. Aphrodite is an adornment to the bathhouse, right? Rather than the bathhouse is an adornment to Aphrodite. What I think that means, in light of the next two answers, is that this isn't a bathhouse for Aphrodite in the sense that this is a temple for Aphrodite. Aphrodite's here because Aphrodite is nice looking and we want the bathhouse to be a pleasant place. Right? It's not a mikvah and me'asharim. This is supposed to be a pleasant experience. So and that fits, I think, very well with the next two answers. This answer after that is almost sarcastic. Right? In other words, the Mishnah says, if people paid you, he says to the philosopher, if people paid you, you wouldn't go into your temple and urinate, be naked, suffer from a flux. But this one, this Aphrodite in this bathhouse, stands there and everyone comes in and urinates and bathes naked in front of this statue. It's not like we're treating this statue with any sort of respect. So the Gemara goes into this, right? There, if that's the way the Gemara is going to say, if the way in which a god is worshipped is through that particular rite, then that's a different story. But Aphrodite, to the best of our knowledge, was not worshipped in these fashions. And finally, the clincher is that the Mishnah tells us that the only prohibition here is Elohehem, if you treat the graven image like a god. But if you don't treat it like a god, then you haven't violated, forget the second commandment, but you haven't even violated the problem of deriving benefit from idolatry. In other words, deriving benefit is not what's at stake here. Idolatry, the definition of idolatry, is what's at stake here. If this was truly idolatrous, then perhaps Rabbi Gamliel would have been in hot water. But inasmuch as this is not an idol, why? Because it's not being treated like a god. It's just a graven image. Graven images per se aren't a problem. So therefore, Rabbi Gamliel doesn't have a problem. It fits perfectly, I think, with our analysis of the Dibur HaSheni and with the prologue to Melachim Beis' narration of Chizkiyahu's reign. Namely, the problem with creating graven images is when you worship them. So in order to create an idol, it has to be worshipped. If it hasn't been worshipped, it's not an idol.
But that sense of your worship, doesn't it matter what the intent of the creation of the idol is?
Yes, right. So that's precisely what the point that the Mishnah is making here. This isn't being treated, you aren't worshipping this, right? In other words, the Mishnah says, if I paid you, you wouldn't go into your temple and do all of these things in front of your idol there. So the fact that you're doing it in front of the idol here shows that even you aren't worshipping this idol. It could be in another context you worship Aphrodite, but Aphrodite isn't being conceived here as sort of like a metaphysical abstract unity such that if you worship Aphrodite anywhere, you worship it everywhere. I think the Mishnah is working with the conception that each individual idol has to be treated in a certain way. There's a source that we examined. We're already in new material, but one of the sources that we had examined last time was a source from, I'm upset I left it off, a source from Minucius Felix, one of the early Christian writers, in which he actually makes this point explicit, and he explains how the process of idol manufacturing in his time, sort of in the Greco-Roman period, was that you would sort of create this item out of wood or out of stone or out of gold or what have you, but it wouldn't become a god until the moment when it was consecrated. Until then, it was just a thing. So each idol, I think, was conceived of in individualized terms rather than just as sort of being a focal point for the worship of it.
Is there any data or literature to suggest that they actually were created individually as just artistic, pieces of art, decorative pieces as opposed to if you had it in your home and you were
right.
Jewish, did you have it in your home because it was pretty or did you have it in your home because you actually felt that there was some sort of power to it?
Right, so I think the bathhouse is a good example. In other words, there is the fact that there are idols in a bathhouse, I think speaks to some sort of ritual element that may have undergirded the bathing experience. But by the time it gets to sort of Eretz Yisrael in the 4th century, the fact that you have an idol in a bathhouse is just sort of because how else are you supposed to make a bathhouse? It's just there. It looks nice. I don't think that there's a ritual. I don't think that there's a ritual element to it. And there's evidence that that's the case as well.
So where does this go about visiting church?
Right. So we're actually going to get to that in source number 4.
But what about the floor?
Right. So
the service when you bow down on the floor like Yom Kippur.
Right.
Down on
right. True. So the question that we have to deal with now is the following.
I'm asking,
Let's leave the. We're gonna come back to the floor at the end. But Mr. Deegan is raising an important issue, which is, in other words, how does the floor with Helios on it fit into this picture? So I think at this point we would say, well, Helios, yes.
It's like the bathhouse. This is a floor for adornment.
Yeah,
it's, not a floor
it's pretty.
For worship.
Right, it's pretty.
Yeah, so you're
exactly.
So I'm glad
Mr. Deegan raised that. So now Mr. Deegan is raising what in halachic parlance, Mr. Deegan is raising the issue of wouldn't it be misinterpreted? In other words, you have a floor that has an image on it that, as far as we know so far, right, we haven't examined the Bavli yet, but as far as we know so far, this isn't the problematic image because it's for adornment. But if you're bowing down on that floor, and again, remember, as Mr. Deegan points out, this floor is right in front of the Aron, at least as we can reconstruct it, I think very reliably based on the archaeology. This floor was right in front of the Aron, so if you're bowing down onto it, can't that be misinterpreted?
And wasn't it common in other shuls?
Right. This is not by any means a unique floor. That is correct. Although I believe the Beit Alpha floor only has a sun disk. It doesn't have Helios's face. But I don't think it makes a big difference. But what Mr. Deegan is raising is an issue that we would call in halachic parlance either maris ayin, or in this particular case what we would call chashda. Right, a problem of being suspected of having done something wrong. So we're going to get to that in source number 4. But for the moment, take a look at the Mishnah of Avodah Zarah in the third parak right over here. The Mishnah actually makes explicit the point that emerged from our analysis of the source with Aphrodite, which is to say, Kol hatzlamim asurim, v'bnei shehem ne'avadim achas b'shana, div Rebbe Meir. V'chachamim omrim, eino asar, ela kol sheyesh b'yado makel o tzipor o kador. V'shimon Gamliel omer, kol sheyesh b'yado kol davar. Okay. The Mishnah says the following. We have to be careful in terms of how we interpret it. The Mishnah says, all statues are prohibited because they have been worshipped at least once a year. In other words, we can presume, according to Rebbe Meir, that a statue, at least if it's owned by a Gentile, the assumption here is that it's owned by a Gentile, if a statue has been owned by a Gentile, then it's been worshipped at least once. That's the assumption. Now, what about the Chachamim? The Chachamim come along and say, what? So in other words, what is the opinion of the Chachamim, the sages, right after that? The sages say, one is only prohibited if there is a staff in its hand, or a bird, or a sphere. Now, what does that mean? Especially in relation to Rabbi Meir's opinion. Someone state for me Rabbi Meir's opinion, and then the sages' opinion. Rabbi Meir's opinion is that, in terms of classifying something as idolatrous, as long as it's a statue that's owned by a Gentile, we can presume that it's been worshipped. Now, what about the sages?
They're actively
worshipping
it?
Right, so I think Sally's correct. In other words, there are actually two ways to read this, and I think Sally's hit it on the head. The first way that we could have read it, which I think is not correct, is the sages are saying, no. All statues are prohibited. Certain, in other words, Rebbe Meir is saying all statues are prohibited, and the rabbis are saying, true. All statues we can presume, let's say, to be
prohibited.
Right. Sorry, my apologies. Right. In other words, no statues. Not all statues are prohibited. Really. Only statues that have something in their hands. However, whether or not they've been worshipped, as long as they have the staff in their hand, or a bird or a sphere, they're prohibited. I don't think that's the correct way to read the Mishnah.
If they have an attribute, then they're prohibited.
Right, in other words, if that's...
If they're missing, anthropomorphizing them. It's showing them that they have a power as opposed to being an
image. Right. I think what Chazal are doing here actually is doing something different, which is what they're saying is... In order for a statue to be prohibited, it has to, and notice the language that they're using is eino asar ella. Eino asar ella means, in other words, you don't say eino asar ella, it's not prohibited, but in the case, unless you're building off something that comes before you. So what Chazal are saying here is that, or rather what the Chachamim are saying here is that they're building off of Rabbi Meir's assumption. Rabbi Meir had assumed that all statues, all images, are prohibited because they've been worshipped. The Chachamim say, no, only images that had only images of the ones owned by Gentiles that we can presume to have been worshipped, that also have a staff and a staff or a bird or a sphere. Why? Because those are the ones that we can presume to have been worshipped if they're owned by Gentiles. In other words, yes.
I want to modify what you just said.
Yes.
I think that we're missing the symbolism, which is historical, that I'm not familiar with, of the hand, the bird, the sphere.
Right.
This must have implication for some sort of religiosity or some sort of worship.
Right, that's Greco-Roman imagery.
Okay, but the point of the matter is that I think that Rabbi Meir is answering all statues, period. If he lived then,
right.
Now, all throughout time, statues that
right.
They're of the Zara. What Chazal is saying, in contrast to that, is no, only statues that are created for idolatry, for instance, those that would contain a staff in the hand of a bird or a sphere, which obviously have historical or statues.
That's absolutely correct, and that happens to be how the Rishonim and the Achronim read this Mishnah, which is precisely that. In other words, we could have read this as saying all statues, regardless of whether they've been worshipped, of whether they're cultic, or of whether they've been made for idolatrous purposes, as long as they have a staff, a bird, or a sphere, they're out. I think the proper way to read this is the way that you're suggesting, and the way that Sally was suggesting, I think, which is that the Chachamim are qualifying Rabbi Meir's view. Rabbi Meir says statues are prohibited, essentially, once they've been worshipped. And it happens to be that Rabbi Meir defines all Gentile-owned statues as falling into that category. However, the Chachamim say that's not strictly speaking the case. The Chachamim say it's true that in order for a statue to be prohibited, it needs to be worshipped. However, we define that not as any statue that's owned by Gentile, but specifically a statue that has in its hand a staff, a bird, or a sphere. And then along comes Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and says, no. It's true, again, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel buys the premise of Rabbi Meir, which is to say that in order for a statue to be prohibited, it needs to have been worshipped, exactly as emerged from our analysis of the second commandment. But the way that we know that it's been worshipped is not simply because it's been owned by a Gentile, which is Rabbi Meir's view, or because it's holding a staff, a bird, or a sphere, which was the view of the Chachamim, but all it needs to be holding is anything. As long as it's holding anything, even if it's not a staff, a bird, or a sphere. If it's holding anything in its hand, we can presume that it's been worshipped. The common denominator of all of these views is that our analysis of the Mishnah involving Aphrodite is correct, which is that the problem, which is that a graven image becomes a problem precisely because it was, in the words of the Mishnah, ne'evad, because it was worshipped. That's what makes something into an idolatry problem. Yes. Prior to that, it's just an image. It's just a picture.
There still is an active view that all statues are avodah zarah. That's not like an antiquated...
Where have we seen that so far, though? You're right, we're going to see that in the next source. But where have we seen that so far? Oh no! Right. That is true. That is true. Right, but no. The idea that all statues are a problem, regardless of their context, is not just a view in halacha. It's an important view in halacha. But another, in terms of figuring out where it comes from, we haven't seen a source for it yet. We're going to see a source for it in source number 4. Yes. Right. In other words, and the Christians have their own issues with this, right? The iconoclastic controversy.
It's not cleared up the problem, because if you look at the Apollo, we've got the sphere, the Earth.
Ah, right. So in other words, had this mosaic...
He doesn't have the chariot.
Right, so this mosaic is a problem, because he's actually holding two of the three things that the Chachamim specify, which is a staff, although you can't... I don't know if you can see it here, but he's also holding a sphere. He's also holding a sphere. So this is bad. However, who owns this mosaic floor?
A shul.
A shul. Right. So we can't presume that it's been nevad achas b'shana, right?
I think we're over-hassling this point.
No.
It seems that Rabbi Meir feels that nobody would make a statue purely for aesthetic reasons, and unless it had functional reasons for worship, and therefore he says that all statues fall into that category. The others are saying no, that you could make a, could make a statue for aesthetic reasons.
Right.
And the only ones that would be for worship. How do we know if they worship? If they contain, this is how they worship.
So I want to come back to Mr. Comet's point at the end, which is that what really is at stake here is a theory of aesthetics. I think that really is what's at stake here. And we're going to have to return to that. But before we can flesh out exactly who holds what within that context, we need to see what the Bavli says. Right, that we're going to get to, I think, more in our analysis next week, which is what we can see here in terms of a microcosm. What I hope to show next time is that this is a problem that has afflicted, or that had afflicted Judaism for 600 years, maybe longer, is the question of how to deal with the sun. Hey, all of us remember the famous, I'm teasing next week a little bit, all of us remember the famous midrash about how Avraham discovers HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? So we have all these midrashim about how Avraham arrives at monotheism precisely because the Torah doesn't explain why HaKadosh Baruch Hu elects Avraham to be his representative or to be his the patriarch of the chosen people. So Chazal attempt to provide reasons. I think that's an important question in and of itself. But we all remember the famous midrash about how Avraham discovers monotheism. He discovered it by intuiting that the celestial bodies could not themselves be gods because each one is eclipsed by another one, no pun intended. In other words, the sun is taken over from by the moon is accompanied by stars, and then all of them are swept away when the sun comes out again. The celestial bodies and how they're received by people and how they're perceived by people in terms of what religious significance is ascribed to them is very much a live issue. And as we're going to see next week, and especially beginning in the time of the Navi Yechezkel, the prophet Ezekiel, the question of sun worship is very, very, very much a hot-button issue. And so we're going to see how the Nevi'im deal with this, how Chazal deal with this, how Jews in general, how common Jews deal with this. But for now, getting back to this, let's take a look at source number four, because as Ellie is pointing out, it can't be that the notion that graven images in general are a problem comes from nowhere. Where does it come from? So it's important to point out that until now, I don't think we've seen that view anywhere in our sources. But that said, it must come from somewhere. It's such a, it's just such a mainstay of our reading of the Second Commandment, so where does it come from? So take a look at source number four. We'll begin with the Mishnah. So if our hypothesis is correct, the view of the Mishnah should be that, well, should be what with respect to images? That images are a problem only insofar as they've been worshipped. So take a look at the Mishnah in source number four. Dmus tsuros levanos hayulo l'rabin Gamliel ba'aliyaso al hatabla ba'kosel shabahen ma'res ha'hadyotos va'omer lahem ha'kazera yiso kazeh. Rabin Gamliel, this is probably the Rabin Gamliel of Yavne, of the 2nd century, or probably first century. So Rabin Gamliel, 1st, 2nd century. Rabbi Gamliel would be entrusted with making astronomical determinations with respect to the new month, right? With respect to Rosh Chodesh. And what aided him in doing this was that he had actually a chart, a fully illustrated chart of the phases of the moon that he would have in his on a tablet on the wall of his upper chamber, and he would show it to people. And in other words, when witnesses who claimed to have seen the new moon would come to him and say, I saw the moon. So he would say, well, point up here, what did you see? So now, Rabbi Gamliel essentially has artwork in his upper chamber. What the nature of this artwork is it three-dimensional? Is it two-dimensional? So for now, we don't know. But what is clear is that Rabbi Gamliel has artwork in his attic, and this needs to somehow be explained. Or maybe, at least maybe it needs to be explained.
Is art or is a picture the same as a statue? It doesn't seem that it is.
Well, again, it depends if Pasuk Dalid from the Second Commandment. Right, so again, it depends.
But it almost seems that a statue is worse than a picture.
Right.
And then it depends on, if the qualifying is, do you worship either or?
Right. Right. So in other words, again, a lot depends on whether Pasuk Dalet is part of the second commandment or whether it's separate from the second commandment. If it's separate, maybe having any image is a problem. So we're going to see. Now, from the Mishnah, we can't tell. As we're going to see in a moment, the Yerushalmi, I think, suggests a very specific answer to this question. But let's see what the Bavli has to say. We're running out of time, but the Bavli says as follows. Vatanya. So the Bavli takes this as a very difficult issue. In other words, how could Rabbi Gamliel have these pictures? So the Bavli says, Vatanya, losa suniti, losas, in other words, you shall not make with me. Again, and notice that he is, the Gemara here is assuming that there is a problem with making images. So what's the problem? Lo sason kidmus shamasha hamashamshin ulfanai kigon chama ulvana kochav mazalos. You can't, part of the prohibition of making images is that you can't make images of the celestial bodies. That in and of itself is a problem. Whether or not it's being worshipped. Shani Rabbi Gamliel. So why is Rabbi Gamliel different? Shani Rabbi Gamliel da cheir masulo. Right? Because others made it for him. Right? If someone else makes it for you, if you didn't make it yourself, then you're not in violation of the second commandment. Okay. That's the answer that the Bavli gives. But then the Bavli goes a step further. Bavli says, Vaha Rav Yehuda da cheir masulo. Va'amar le Shmuel Rav Yehuda shinana sami eni dedain. Apparently, Rav Yehuda had an image of his own. Rabbi Yehuda, this is the second generation, 3rd century CE, Babylonian Amora, and his teacher, Shmuel, said to him the following. Rabbi Yehuda, you who have these statues in your house, blind the eyes of them. In other words, you got to get rid of them. They're no good. Why? Others made them for him, the Gemara says. But didn't others make them for him? If it's true that others making it for you means that these statues are not a problem, then, and which seems to have been the answer from Gamliel, then how can Shmuel object to these statues? So the answer is, it must be that others making them for you is not sufficient. And the Gemara says what? And this brings us back to Dr. Schwartzbaum. Hasam chosama bole taya umishum chashta. And it throws in, and it sprinkles in Mr. Deegan as well. Right? The problem here is that, as the Gemara says, in that case, its signet image was protruding, and Shmuel prohibited it because of suspicion, of violation of the second commandment. In other words, Shmuel had a ring with an image on it, and the way the ring worked was that there are basically two ways that you could sign with a ring, with a signet ring. Either the ring could be indented, so that when you push down on the wax, a raised image comes off of it, or you could have a protruding image from your ring. That way, when you push down on the wax, there's an imprint in the wax. So apparently, Rabbi Yehuda's problem was that his signet ring was, the image was three-dimensional, right? It was sticking out, so it looked like a statue. So the fact that Shmuel had it rendered him susceptible to the charge of being in violation of the second commandment. What's the problem with that? Of course it wasn't meant to be worshipped. Rabbi Yehuda was keeping Avodah Zarah in his house? God forbid. The fact that Rabbi Yehuda had a protruding signet ring meant that it was almost by definition that it wasn't being worshipped. So clearly, if that's the case, which it no doubt is, so what is the Bavli assuming? Bavli is assuming that how do you violate the second commandment? Any 3D possession, any statue-like possession. I think that's exactly correct. Now the Gemara qualifies that this is not a violation of the second commandment per se. It's mishum chashta. It's because someone might suspect you of violating the second commandment. Okay. Now the Gemara continues. Umichai shinon lachashta. Is it really true that we have to be concerned about what people are going to think, Maris Ayin? Do we really have to be concerned that people are going to suspect Jews of violating the second commandment on a regular basis? V'ha, hi be'knish d'shafi yasiv, b'nahardeya, d'ave be'andrata, There was a synagogue in Shav Yosef in the town of Nahardea in Babylonia that had a statue in it, a statue of a man in it, and Stam, Rav and Shmuel and Shmuel's father would come into the shul all the time and they would daven there. What big deal? And no one was suspecting them of violating the second commandment. Right? This was a statue that they owned. That was in their shul. It was certainly a 3D graven image. No one suspected them of violating the second commandment. So the Gemara says, Rabim Shani. It's different if you're in public. Vahar Rab Gamliel Yachid Hu. Right, if you're in private, so people can think maybe you're violating the second commandment. I know I'm not, but you might. If you're in shul, so we presume that it's a... If you're in public, we presume that it's a place where everybody's going to see you. And if you really wanted to worship it, people would catch you, right? So if you're in public, we can presume that you're not violating the commandment. And then the Gemara says that apparently Rabbi Gamliel was because he was the Nasi. The Bavli assumes that this Rabbi Gamliel was the Nasi. I don't know if we actually did this in this class. Who the Nasi is and where he comes from. But I think we did it on Shavuos, right? I think we did it on Shavuos last year. We did something on the Nasi. But in any event, the Bavli assumes that Rabbi Gamliel was the Nasi at this time. I think the pshat is that Rabbi Gamliel was not the Nasi, but that's for another class. Maybe we'll do that later this semester. But in any event, Rabbi Gamliel, because he was the Nasi, that's like being in public. And then finally, V'yibay seim elahislamed avad uchsiv lo solmad la'asos v'altalamed lahavin elahoros. Right? If you just have something for educational purposes, that's a different story. Having it for educational purposes is fine. If you have an image for aesthetic purposes, that might be worse. Now, what's clear is that all of these answers that we just gave are ways to get out of being suspected of violating the second commandment. However, it's clear from one of the earlier answers that a proviso of all of this is that you can't be the one who made the image. Others, presumably Gentiles, have to have made it for you.
Unless God tells you to make it
right. Right, the Kruvim are a perfect example, right? How do we have Kruvim?
Picture of Hashem in the Sistine Chapel.
Right.
Presumably, as long as you don't actually worship it, even the Gentiles don't worship that statue, it's merely decorative, or it's not right at the heart of it.
I think the problem here was that the presumption of the Mishnah, we could say that things have changed, but I think the presumption of the Mishnah is that, again, ask your local Orthodox rabbi. This class is, if I haven't anything higher than a resident scholar, if I haven't said it before, then I'll say it again. This class is the definition of halacha v'lo l'maisa. But that said, I think a fair reading of the Mishnah is that the presumption is that if an image is owned by a Gentile, it's been worshipped. It could be that we know, based on certain contemporary circumstances, that maybe that's not the case. But I think that's you can and maybe should read the Mishnah as just saying that's the presumption. The presumption is that anything owned by an idol worshipper has been worshipped. So if you wanted to aser going into the Sistine Chapel, which obviously is one view, you maybe would do it on those grounds. Basically, Losid Bakum Menacherim grounds. Right. Now, before we finish here, I want to get to one possible out, and then we'll close. There are a couple of ways that we could excuse the floor in Chamat Tveria, even with this more restrictive reading of the Bavli. So now, we should notice, first of all, the view that all images are problematic, with a couple of exceptions, is rooted, as we see, in the Bavli. It seems not to have been the view of the Yerushalmi. How do I know this? Because the Yerushalmi doesn't even comment on this Mishnah, with respect to Rabbi Gamliel. It doesn't comment on it at all. And there's no source, and in fact, the second commandment is not discussed anywhere in the Mishnah, Tosefta, or Yerushalmi at all. In a formal sense, right? So that's an important point. However, if we wanted to kvetch, we could say, well, listen, in other words, how could we excuse the floor in Chamat Tveria? So we could say, listen, it's in public. Maybe we could justify it on those grounds, right? They had a statue in the shul. The statue was not a problem. Right, maybe non-Jews made it. It's possible. So the problem is, we're out of time, so I'll summarize for you what the sources in number five have. The problem in source number five here, we have a Tosefta that tells us, that seems to presume that an Andratin, right, we read about an Andrata, right, a statue in the shul in the Hardea, which we presumed was only non-problematic because it was in public. So the Tosefta here just assumes as a matter of course that people have statues in their private homes. It doesn't even worry that it's a violation of idolatry. It may be a Tum of a Tower problem, but that's a different story. And then finally, Ira mentioned before this, the Beit Alpha synagogue. So the Beit Alpha synagogue, which is even later, the 6th century CE, has an inscription on the floor which explicitly mentions that the people who made the floor, the hoi technitai, hoi kamnontis, ta ergon, the workers, the ones who carried out the work, are people named Marianos, Kai Aninas, Huos, Marianus and Chanina, his son. Marianus and Chanina, we know, they actually made several pieces of artwork that we've recovered. They're Jewish. So the people who made the artwork in Beit Alpha, which has similar problems to the Chamat Tveri artwork, were Jews. So we can't have the Acherim Asulo, right? We can't have this, we can't adopt the solution uniformly that others made it, so that's why it's not a problem. I think the simple answer is to just adopt the conclusions that we came to through our analysis of the Second Commandment, which is to say that there is a period where the Second Commandment is interpreted as prohibiting statues or graven images or images, period, that have been worshipped in an idolatrous context. That's the problem that the Second Commandment is dealing with. The Bavli, for reasons that we're not going to have time to discuss now, the Bavli, I think, goes a step further and casts aspersions on all sorts of images, even ones that haven't been worshipped, because of a concern of violation of the Second Commandment. This is a gezeira of Chazal. How it's interpreted lahalacha is a different matter, but we should be aware that this is a stage in how halacha develops. I think we'll get to this hopefully later in the semester. Why Chazal evolve in this manner is actually, first of all, obvious based on how the history develops. In other words, images become more and more and more popular, not just among Jews, but among Gentiles as well. Similar trends occur in Gentile thought. They're not connected to this, but they occur as well. The iconoclastic controversy of the Byzantine Empire occurs roughly around the same time.
Protestantism.
Right, but Chazal, for very good reason, I think, sort of broaden the scope of the Second Commandment. But we should be aware that it's a development. Now, where does this leave us? I think where this leaves us is as follows. The Saras HaDibros, whatever status they may have in our religious thought, I think the way that we generally understood Chazal to have conceptualized the Ten Commandments is that the Ten Commandments are no more or less important than anything else. However, just as a matter of history, the Ten Commandments loom large in the popular imagination and in our imagination. I think it's important to note that the Dibur HaSheni, the Second Commandment, which prohibits images of some sort, is the second thing that a Kadosh Baruch Hu tells all of the Jewish people as they're gathered together. That has to count for something. And what is the Second Commandment? So if our analysis is correct, the Second Commandment prohibits a certain type of ritual act, which is to say, it requires of us, no more or less, that we commit firmly and without compromise to the monotheistic vision of Yahadus. And that is an important point. But in terms of what it doesn't prohibit, even if halacha evolves in such a way where it emphatically and irrevocably does prohibit other things that the Second Commandment didn't initially envision, and of course that's how halacha works, and we're bound by that, but it's important to recall that what the second Dibur is not doing is saying all artwork is prohibited. It's not saying all artwork is prohibited. To the extent that I think, in context completely divorced from the Second Commandment, there is a sense, I think, especially in the Orthodox community, that artwork is of dubious value, or that aesthetics are of dubious value. I humbly contest that view. And I think that we as a community cannot exist without a developed sense of the aesthetic. Which is to say that there is no source in the Second Commandment to say that all artwork is outside of the bounds of proper religious expression. On the contrary, the Beis HaMikdash is decorated in beautiful fashion. The one accomplishment which even a Rasha like Herod is praised for is beautifying the Temple Mount, is making our Har HaBayis, the Har HaBayis that we appreciate and love today. To the extent that I think there are members of our community who frown upon a religious experience that incorporates the beauty and the bounty of what this world has to offer, and in particular the accumulated wisdom, however small it may be, of human artists throughout the generations, which I think is inspired ultimately by a sense of the divine, I think we're missing out. So if we can come away with
Bezalel,
right? Bezalel is a model for Jewish history. So to the extent that we can come away with something theologically constructive from this class, I would hope that it would be an understanding of, first of all, what the second commandment says, which is that we as a people are committed uncompromisingly to monotheism, and second of all, and perhaps just as importantly, what it doesn't say, which is that it doesn't disqualify aesthetics from our worldview. And with that, I wish you a good evening. All right.